Okay, lovely. Thank you very much, everybody. So we will now, formally begin. So, hello and welcome to a very special IGCSE History Question Time this evening, hosted by the History Department here at Wellington College. Before I explain the structure of our panel discussion, I'd like to take this opportunity to introduce you to our illustrious panel. So firstly, we are deeply honoured to have our paramount leader, Mr. Loosley. Secondly, someone who has an intimate knowledge of Chinese culture and, of course, its history, having established a history department in Tianjin, if I'm not mistaken.
True.
It's no less than Mr. McLeod. And almost finally, a very welcome addition to this evening's panel, offering a fresh perspective on many of tonight's meaty issues, we have Mrs. Whitelaw. To my right, Mr. Hargreaves will be our... will be our roving mic when we come to questions from the floor. So, welcome, Mr. Hargreaves. Okay, so a reminder about the format of our discussion this evening. So, we will address each topic in turn discreetly. We'll start with Italy, then we'll go to Germany, and we will finally look at China. For each topic, we've pre-selected the most popular burning questions from the audience, and we will spend time discussing different arguments and perspectives as a panel. An innovative feature this evening, never seen before, or possibly again, depending on how this goes, in Question Time History, we have a quick-fire curious questions round for each subject, and in this round, panellists are challenged to answer a question in 10 words or less, rapid fire. To cap all of this off, as if that wasn't enough to delight and nourish your minds, we will also take questions from the floor to bring the session to a democratic and inclusive conclusion. So, without further ado, let's begin. So we turn to Italy, a brief introduction. Italian unification, also known as the Risorgimento, was the political and social movement that consolidated different states of the Italian peninsula into one single state, of the Kingdom of Italy, by 1870-71. The process began with the revolutions of 1848, inspired by previous rebellions in the 1820s and 30s that contested the outcome of the Congress of Vienna. And it was completed when Rome became the capital of the Kingdom of Italy. So our first question relates to 1848. This is from A.N. Other. So in your opinion, was the Statuto the most significant consequence of the 1848 revolutions? So I'll open this one out or up to the panel.
Oh, I'll start. I would say that the Statuto was not the most significant consequence, simply because it's merely for Piedmont. The significance of the 1848 revolutions was it had planted the idea of a nationalist struggle in Italy. And that, I would suggest, is much more significant than a mere sort of structuring of the laws or a constitution of one part of Italy.
Building on that, though, could you not say that because it was the only state that kept its constitution, a lot of radicals and those who'd become nationalists did then move to Piedmont?
Yeah, no, I think you're right. I think it is significant, but I think it's telling it enables nationalists to centre on Turin, which becomes the centre of Italian nationalism. But it's still, you've got rid of Metternich, so the big sort of Austrian sort of beast is gone, and you've got these nationalist heroes who've risen up, like Garibaldi, Mazzini less so, but Garibaldi. These people become sort of cult populist heroes, which I think has profound cultural impact.
Well, I think something to bear in mind I haven't mentioned yet is the papal accusation and the impact of 1848 on the Pope's reputation. Because don't forget, before 1848, there was disagreement among Italian nationalists about what the process of unification should look like. And one of the options was a PN one, yes. Another option was a confederation under the leadership of the Pope. And everyone thought that Pope Pius was a liberal nationalist. But we know through the papal allocution that that reputation goes up in flames. And after 1848, no one who wants a liberal or united Italy sees the Pope as a potential leader. So that leaves the field empty for Piedmont.
Fantastic. I think that's really, really important. In terms of the papal allocution, could one of the panelists just briefly indicate what did it actually do? What did it state?
Right. Well, so the papal allocution, for those of you who don't know, I'm sure you all know, the papal allocution was issued by the Pope in April or so, 1848. Okay. And in the papal allocution, the Pope came out explicitly saying that Italians should obey their current rulers, be they Austrian or Italian, which was an affront to any nationalist. That they should not take up arms against the Austrians. And he basically withdrew papal support, both military and sort of, I don't know, symbolic support from the nationalist cause. So it's a really key moment in terms of destroying the Pope's reputation as a liberal nationalist hero.
Okay, thank you very much. Moving on, a question here from Felipe Joy. What was the most important factor that enabled the final unification of Italy? So this is a hugely popular question, one that often comes up in terms of the exam. What was the most important factor that enabled the final unification of Italy?
Well, certainly not the Italians themselves. That's that straight. You know, the final unification of Italy, we're thinking about that as getting Venetia as part of Italy, getting Rome as part of Italy. Both of those moments in what, 1866 and 1870, are only made possible by developments elsewhere. The Italians were bit players in this drama. It was the Austrians and the French, it was the Austrians and the Prussians fighting it out, and the Italians took the opportunity to get the bits of territory they still wanted. But had those developments not happened elsewhere, then there's no reason why the Italians on their own would have been able to do it.
Okay, so we're saying it's basically the fault of Prussia.
Absolutely.
Okay. Linked to that, and to move things forward, a question here from Ollie Percival. Who was the most influential figure in achieving Italian unification? We haven't there addressed this issue of leadership within Italian unification. So who was the most influential figure in achieving Italian unification? So Cavour, Garibaldi, or Victor Emmanuel would be the classic choices, although we could stretch back maybe a little further and be provocative here. What about Mazzini? What even of Napoleon the First, the original?
So I think that the unification of Italy as a whole was clearly down to Garibaldi. Cavour, Victor Emmanuel, although they're important in getting the northern Italian kingdom first, particularly in the case of Cavour, he never really wanted a unified Italy. He was just interested in expanding Piedmont. So I'd say for pushing north and south, and due to his conquests, it has to be Garibaldi.
Okay, would anybody like to build on that or to perhaps challenge?
Well, I mean, I disagree. I think it's got to be Cavour, simply because he makes it politically possible to... Well, firstly, but to bring in allies, which I think is crucially important, to build Piedmont's economy and status on the European map. It's the way that he manages to improve trade relations and then political relations with France, which builds towards the Second War of Italian unification. And actually, you can always tell it when he dies in 1861... it all kind of falls apart when, you know, we have Victor Emmanuel and Garibaldi sort of having a bit of a tussle over Rome and Victor Emmanuel encouraging him and then withdrawing his support from the campaigns. And it begins to slow down once Cavour is out of the picture, which I think is telling in terms of how significant he was.
Would anybody like to comment on the role of Victor Emmanuel?
Oh, I wasn't going to, but I don't mind doing so. So Victor Emmanuel, well, he's clearly important. But he's also a bit of a klutz, isn't he? I mean, he's a good figurehead, and so long as he stays a figurehead and doesn't get too involved, then he's fine. If he lets Cavour get on with things, well, then that's all great. Because Cavour is clearly very... Well, he's very influential, and he's very capable. When Victor Emmanuel, after Cavour's death, starts to get involved himself and encourages Garibaldi in these ludicrous attempts to capture Rome on his own, that's when Victor Emmanuel starts to be an active hindrance, I think, to unification than a help. So in that sense, I think Victor Emmanuel, he's going to struggle to take the top spot on this one for anything really, except for that fantastic moustache of his, which defies gravity. Cavour, that wispy thing under his chin, on the back of the beard, he clearly loses. But Victor Emmanuel, that's as far as I go with Victor Emmanuel. I was going to say Mazzini. We shouldn't forget about Mazzini. People often do. But in terms of keeping the flame of Italian unification, Italian nationalism alive, before 1848, then Mazzini plays a huge role. You know, he sets up Young Italy, and that's where Garibaldi cuts his teeth as an Italian revolutionary. It's Mazzini who is the key figure for that Republic of Rome in 1848 to 49, if you cast your minds back to that. So perhaps you could argue that without Mazzini, Italian nationalism would never have grown to the extent that it does grow before 1848 and 1850s.
Who got the biscuits named after them?
Yeah. Just saying.
Okay, now I'm getting hungry. So, links to this, but perhaps it enables us to explore this clearly and allows you as students to appreciate the importance of this issue. A question here from Ben Yeldon. So, what would have happened if Victor Emmanuel did not intervene when Garibaldi was marching on Rome? That sort of pivot moment, if you like, in terms of Italian unification history. What do we think would have happened?
Total disaster, I think, would have happened. Because Garibaldi is so hot-headed, and he was intent, wasn't he, on not only capturing Naples and doing that stuff, but then moving on to Rome and taking Rome. That's what he wanted. It's what he always wanted. But had he attacked Rome, then the French would have marched in. They were just waiting for an opportunity to cut the new Kingdom of Italy down to size. And if they could intervene, then maybe they could reverse some of that clever stuff that Cavour had done, where he'd snatched Tuscany and all those extra territories. Yeah. So I think Garibaldi had no sense of that situation at all. He just wanted Rome. So I'm sure for that reason, perhaps, Victor Emmanuel and Cavour could claim to be more influential than Garibaldi, because Garibaldi almost threw the whole thing away if it hadn't been for those two.
Okay, lovely, thank you. So we now come to our curious quick fire questions round. So Mr. Hargreaves here will dig out three or four of these questions, and then panellists will be challenged to answer in 10 words or less.
Oh,
in a really quick, very, very quick response. So, over to Mr. Hargreaves.
So the first one we've got...
Is it on?
Yeah. Hey, which is it is on. To what extent was Italy truly unified by 1870? In 10 words or less.
Barely unified, only geographically. There's another one. And it takes, decades before any more happens.
I'll try and read this handwriting. Maybe struggle. What was the biggest impediment
to the unification process?
What was the biggest impediment to the unification process? Mr. McLeod.
Oh.
If we take at the end, it would probably be Piedmontization. Just about.
Yep. Brilliant. Okay, so last one.
Last question. Was Italian unification forced? Should Italy really have been unified at all?
This is right.
The north definitely south, joining the north, questionable.
Are there any Italians in the room who have a view? Should Italy have been unified? Matty says no.
Okay, we'll move rapidly on. Brilliant. Okay, thank you very much. So we now move to Germany. So our second of three major topics, and a little introduction for you just to whet your appetites and remind you. Okay, so Germany. The First World War was the most destructive war and led to a loss of innocence and deference in Britain, Europe and the globe. The failure of the Weimar Republic, the most liberal democracy in many ways on earth at the time, led to the rise of Nazi Germany, which was the capstone of the interwar period and led to the outbreak of World War II, shattering a tenuous peace. The Nazi regime's progress was paralleled by the life of its leader, Adolf Hitler. Hitler's Germany finally collapsed in 1945, with the Soviets winning the race to Berlin. Germany had been a battleground, literally, and also ideologically or politically, between the left and the right-wing elements that had such contrasting visions for German society. We now turn to this most controversial and important of areas, and we will do things chronologically. So we'll turn to Weimar Germany firstly, and Jess Mundy has proposed the following question, and it's a very, very popular and important one for you. So to what extent was Stresemann responsible for the Golden Age, 1924 to 1928? And just a little intro here. So Gustav Ernst Stresemann was a German statesman who served as Chancellor in 1923. He was Foreign Minister in 1923 to 29 during the Weimar Republic, and he was a joint winner of the Nobel Peace Prize in 1926, the year, of course, in which Germany re-entered the international community and was accepted into the League of Nations, the precursor to the UN. So, to what extent was this man, Gustav Stresemann, responsible for the Golden Age, 1924 to 1928?
I think Stresemann is hugely important. Everyone sort of knows him for the rent and mark and to solve the hyperinflation issues, but people tend to forget that he was a foreign minister first and foremost, and actually it's the international relations where he's really, really important. Things like the Locarno Pact, the Treaty of Berlin. So the Locarno Pact is the agreement with France, whereby it guarantees the demilitarization of the Rhineland. The Treaty of Berlin is where he firms up his relationship with Russia after the end of the First World War, which was still a little bit up in the air, especially after Locarno. And then, of course, joining the League of Nations and winning the Nobel Peace Prize. That man put Germany back onto the world map and the world stage in a proper way, and Germany became accepted because of him. But internally, that's a different sort of question. So it's the Golden Age. It may well be that you look elsewhere.
So in terms of his financial impact as well, you've got solving the hyperinflation crisis of 1923 with the new currency. You have organising some loans and a longer payment of the reparations with America. So that was certainly important. However, he did himself say Germany is dancing on a volcano, recognising how unstable and dependent they were on America. And obviously when the Wall Street crash happened in 1929, that all imploded.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a good issue there raised about whether whatever Stresemann was responsible for, can we really call it a golden age? I think Miss Whitelaw is absolutely spot on. It's an economic recovery based on American loans. It doesn't solve unemployment, which is still unusually high in the 1920s. The rural areas of Germany are being largely bypassed by this recovery, and it's those areas which will prove such fertile ground for Nazi Party support. So Stresemann, he's clearly a hugely influential figure. The only real statesman that Weimar Republic produced, but I'm not sure his achievements can rank so high as to be the golden age of Weimar Republic.
Yeah, absolutely. I would like to build on that as well, just in terms of your awareness. So Stresemann was a nationalist himself. He was a nationalist leader before and during the course of the First World War. So this strong current of nationalism is super significant. And all of these comments we've just had about the stability or lack of stability within Weimar Germany, so significant. Because with Stresemann we see a balanced perspective. Somebody who believed in his nation, who was nationalist, but balanced, and he was progressive. And then, of course, a different brand of nationalism comes in under at the time of Greece stress and collapse. And we're actually about to look at that very issue right now. So, and we now move to looking at Hitler's rise to power, an extremely popular question. Lots and lots of questions came in to us as teachers on this very topic. Lexi Miller proposed one of these questions here. So he asked, would you argue that the main reason that Hitler became Chancellor was the depression across Germany? And that leads to a deeper issue, perhaps, which would be very closely corresponding. What was the most significant factor that led to Hitler becoming Chancellor of Germany in 1933? So is it the depression, or is it something else? What is it? Let's just settle the dispute that has raged ever since this happened.
So definitely in terms of votes for the Nazis, so no one's really voting for them before 1929. Then after that, hugely, the votes for the Nazis vastly increases. Whether it's the main factor, I mean, the Nazis weren't the only party who were offering an alternative. I mean, Hitler had said we should never take loans from the Americans, so the fact that it all imploded made him look correct, but other extremists had said the same thing. So I suppose the question is, why did people turn to the Nazis as opposed to the alternatives?
Well, I think the answer to that question is going to be Hitler himself. There are a whole load of right-wing parties in Germany arguing for the sort of things that Hitler's arguing for. So, yeah, the crash comes, the depression hits, people are looking for political alternatives, there's the communists on the left, but there's a whole load of options on the right. Why the Nazi Party over all the others? It's got to be Hitler, his ability as a speaker, his branding of the Nazi Party from the early 20s with the swastika and the Heil Hitler, the SA with their the clear impression of order and kind of discipline at a time when all of that was collapsing around Germans. Made people think that the Nazi Party deserved their vote. So there's definitely something distinctive about Hitler. It's more than just there's a depression, because people voted for Hitler over other options.
I mean, I think you've got to also take into account the weakness of Weimar Germany. The fact is that the Weimar Constitution and the fact that it had proportional representation at its heart, whereby the percentage of votes you got with the percentage of seats you had in the Reichstag, meant that they couldn't ever really form a majority government. So they were always coalition governments. That was less of an issue when it was relatively stable and relatively well off in the 1920s, but after the Wall Street crash, that becomes an absolute nightmare, because you do have the political parties leaving the centre, and that makes it even harder for them to work together. And so Article 48 becomes more and more significant. Bruning, of course, famously uses it quite a bit, the Hunger Chancellor. So actually, a lot of this stuff can be found in the weakness of the Weimar Constitution.
Yeah, absolutely. I'd like to just add to that in terms of the weakness of the left. We think about the Communist Party, the KPD, and what they offer. They actually offer, because of their class-based politics, and nothing, as it were, to the middle class within Germany. And if we reflect on the deep financial impact, an impact on opportunity and a lack of stability for not Germany wholesale, but particularly the middle class, the lower middle class, and the fact that the KPD offer them nothing other than fear, is actually a deep issue here, I think. In addition to that, you have a powerful coalition that group around Hitler and his right-wing leadership, because they are hugely concerned about the threat to their business interests of what looks like an increasingly powerful KPD who could mobilise something of a revolutionary movement against business within Germany. And this would be deeply disturbing to those who actually are in control of Germany's industry and the business community. So I'd say you should reflect on that.
But all that having been said, I think we still haven't quite uncovered the real main cause, because all the things we've covered so far bring Hitler to the door of power, but not through the threshold. By 1932, the Nazi Party is the largest party in the Reichstag, but they do not have a majority. And Hindenburg has said to Hitler, "I'm not going to be appointing you as Chancellor." And he appoints von Schleicher, and he tries von Papen, what have you. But the final ingredient, but crucial ingredient, is a miscalculation of your conservatives around Hindenburg, who tell Hindenburg in January 33 that if you appoint Hitler but have von Papen as your vice-chancellor, we can control him. We can have, we give him a couple of Nazis in the cabinet, outnumber them in the cabinet, and we can use his popularity while dictating to him actually what's going to happen. And they made a fatal, for some of them, miscalculation by underestimating Hitler in that instance. But without that miscalculation, Hitler couldn't force his way into power. He had to be given it.
Yeah, absolutely. Many, many historians would agree. The greatest miscalculation, potentially, in history. Okay, we have one final quick question from Matthew Patty on Germany. To what extent did Hitler achieve his aims from 1933 to 1945? To what extent did Hitler actually achieve his aims?
I think the big question here is actually whether Hitler had any clear aims anyway between those years, whether actually he sort of almost stumbles his way through the 30s into the 40s. You look for the way you find the aims, you look at the 25-point programme, that's 1920. You look at Mein Kampf, and that's 1923-4. There isn't, or his speeches, which were of course propaganda elements, so they weren't necessarily sort of big policies. That said, of course, he does a huge he solves unemployment. That's a massive success, you'd say, through the German Labour Front, strength through joy campaigns. I'd say that was probably his biggest success and his biggest challenge when he came to power.
Although, in terms of economics, he fails to make Germany self-sufficient, so an autarky, which was the aim. They're not really prepared for war, running short of crucial supplies, rubber, oil, by the time of the war. I suppose the unemployment figures are slightly skewed by the fact that they sack women, and obviously removed Jewish people, which does kind of slightly skew is what they've managed to achieve.
But I think he definitely does have aims. I take issue with that. He wants to tear up the Treaty of Versailles. He wants to create a one-party state and get rid of democracy, and he wants to use that to take Lebensraum, living space in the east of the growing German nation. I think he's got quite a clear sense of what he wants to achieve. I don't think he quite knows how he's going to achieve it. In terms of does he achieve his aims, 1933 to 45, well, no, because clearly he ends up shooting himself in 45, so that doesn't feel like success to me. But 1933 to 39, 1933 to 41, he seems to achieve quite a few of his aims, quite a lot of them. And I think he threw it all away with the invasion of the Soviet Union in 1941, which he didn't need to do. Did it because ultimately, when he made his decisions during World War II, he put the Nazi Party first, the Nazi Party ideology first, rather than the German military strategic interest. He took on the Soviet Union because they were communists and he wanted to kill the communists. But in so doing, he got a war on two fronts, and he kind of awakened the Russian bear, which was always going to be a problem once it was up and running. So he did very well at the start, but he threw all away during World War II.
Okay, excellent. So we have come full circle. So we'll now go to our quick, curious questions on Germany. Off again.
So the first one, to what extent did Adolf Hitler's early life shape his political views and ideologies?
Okay.
research.
Yeah, of course. To what extent did Adolf Hitler's early life shape his political views and his ideology?
Okay.
Early life, so from a young age, hatred towards Jewish people, very much militaristic, about strong Germany, experiences in World War I gave him that hatred of Treaty of Versailles from day one.
Excellent answer. A bit more than 10 words.
Yeah, I forgot the 10 words.
Right. Let's move on to the next question.
What was the primary motive behind the Nazis' final solution? Mr.
McCall. The genocide of the European Jewish race?
Yeah.
Good answer.
Yeah, okay, so this one is from Charlie E. So out of Mao, Hitler, and Stalin, who achieved the most? And it says here, to what consequences? Mr. Lewisley?
10 words.
Stalin achieves the most. Hitler shoots himself. Mao... Yeah, he's not dying. So it's Stalin. I mean, yeah.
Okay, brilliant. Wonderful. I'm liking this new addition to question time. Okay, so China. We're going to move on to our final subject now, so China. Brief introduction. So China, at a time of such extremes afflicted China from 1900 to 1989, unlike anything experienced by any other nation on Earth, what was the most significant changes and continuities? What were they? What are the qualities of its leaders and their policies? What role did foreign influence play in the development of what many consider today to be the most powerful nation on Earth? Our first question from Will Hooper. To what extent was Mao a bad leader, considering his political reforms and the effects of these against or versus his brutality and failures? So, yeah, to what extent was Mao a bad leader?
Well, I'm sure Will will be the first to point out that to answer this question, in answering this question, it depends what you mean by bad, right? Was he a bad leader? He's an enormously successful leader. So against that metric, he's a good leader. Because unsuccessful leaders, surely by definition, are bad leaders. He does achieve what he wants to achieve. So he probably died reasonably happy. Was he a nice leader? Well, clearly no. Would we want him in charge of our country? No. He is brutal, he's ruthless, he takes no prisoners, but he did put China on the path to the economic superpower that it is today. He doesn't get them all the way there, but he definitely achieves a great deal. So I think he's good against all that, but those measures, but he's clearly not a nice man.
I mean, I disagree. You can't say that the guy who's responsible for the largest famine in human history was a success. The fact is that actually, and to be fair to him, he was acting, and his party was acting. He'd set up a system whereby people were lying to him, and he was acting on those lies. But the other thing which I would say again is unsuccessful or certainly bad leadership is the fact he's willing to throw China into practical civil war in the Cultural Revolution to regain personal power. That to me is bad leadership. And the Cultural Revolution takes a lot of effort to mop up. In fact, they're still doing it to a large extent. So, a bad leader.
That, in a sense, leads us to another consideration, a comparative question. This is based on a question that Poppy Johnson put forward. And at its essence, it is about this. So who brought the most benefit to China then? So to Mao or Deng, right? We're allowed to sort of manipulate things in that way. Is it Mao? Is it Deng? What's the stronger argument, stronger side?
Deng. This is another thing I think I disagree with Mr. Loosley on. Is that actually, I think it's Deng who puts China on the path to it being a global superpower, because it's only through creating those special enterprise zones, and you only have to look at the expansion of those into modern China to see how successful they were. I mean, Shenzhen is a great example, one of the original ones at SEZs, right next to Hong Kong. It started off as a fishing village, practically. It is now one of the biggest and most successful cities in China. Deng, by releasing sort of the capitalist potential of China, pushes China to astonishing growth, an average growth of 7% a year. And that had not been achieved under Mao at all. Mao was nowhere near that. Deng's great failure, of course, was to not do it alongside political reforms. And, of course, that does create issues. But again, arguably, he deals with it fairly successfully. You know, we have the 89 Tiananmen Square massacre, but it's a massacre, and if you go to China, they don't really know much about it. So, frankly, that was quite successful too.
Well, I mean, certainly, economically, Deng Xiaoping does bring enormous benefits to China. But I wonder, though, whether any of that really would have been possible without the impact of Mao. Because if we do a little bit of change in continuity with Mao, you just picture China before Mao really becomes significant. So 1933, 1934, just before the Long March, you've got a disunited China. You've got warlords who have been kind of defeated by Chiang Kai-shek, but not quite. And you've got a weak China that is the plaything for other countries to manipulate and exploit. And by the time he has died, what Mao has done is he has unified China. He has made China a nuclear power, a international playmaker on the world stage. Now, the Americans are looking to make friends with China once again. So I think that if you look, imagine China at the start of Mao's career and the end of it, and his political impact and his impact on the nation of China is huge. And I don't know whether Deng Xiaoping's economic reforms could have been successful without such a strong political foundation of the one-party state that Mao created. So on those grounds, I think Mao brought the most benefit to China.
Okay, I feel like the debate will rumble on. but we need to move on. So our final major consideration for China is a really useful one for you in the audience. The broad context here is thinking about significance and, again, change over time. And we need to here look at foreign influence. So Serena Morrison has put forward this question in relation to foreign influence. To what extent were the USSR and their alliance with China helpful in relation to China's development? So to what extent were the USSR and their alliance with China helpful in relation to China's development?
Hugely. Especially... Well, even from before Mao comes to power, they are the ones who are... They've always got a hand in China. They're the ones who created the United Front between the KMT and the CCP in the Northern Expedition, which, of course, Chiang Kai-shek breaks. But actually, of course, you can see their influence mostly after Mao comes to power, whereby it's Soviet advisors who are working in Chinese industry, which really pushes... the Chinese heavy industry to its heights in the first five-year plan. Of course, this whole thing is tainted a little bit by a mistrust, a lack of faith between those two countries. So it never quite takes off in the way that it perhaps would have done. But I think the first five-year plan is a good example of Soviet intervention being quite helpful to China's development.
Okay. Excellent. Just... quickly, overall, do you feel that foreign influence on China was more significant from 1900 to 1948 than the second sort of big chunk of the chronology from sort of 49 to 89? Is it more significant in that early period, 1900 to 48, or is it more significant from 49 to 1989?
Well, I think that the nature of foreign influence certainly changes quite significantly between the first part period and the second period. If you think about foreign influence in the first half, think of the Boxer Rebellion, think about Japanese invasion, think about kind of during the warlord era, foreign influence is hugely disruptive, damaging to China's kind of national unity. Whereas in the second part of the period, I think the Chinese are better able to make foreign influence work for them and on their terms. So you can see that in the first five-year plan, as just mentioned, making good use of Soviet technical know-how. And then when the Chinese have had enough of the Soviet Union, they kick them out. Okay, so they're in control. And then later on, you get Nixon visiting China in 1972, China now being seen as a partner on the world stage. And then crucially in the 1980s, where Deng Xiaoping opens the door to foreign influence economically and on terms that he dictates. And with the democracy movement, which is kind of like Western influence, but unofficial Western influence, he is able to use the government's force to suppress that. So I think if there's a key change in foreign influence from the beginning to the end, I think that's the crucial difference.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah.
Brilliant. So now we'd just like to open up to the floor. So questions from the floor. So you just think about some questions. We'll take 5 minutes now to take some questions from you guys in the audience. So just if you've got a question, just pop your hand up. Thank you very much.
Question over here. If Hitler didn't invade the Soviet Union, to what extent do you believe that Hitler could have stayed in power for a longer time or created a superpower with his Nazi party?
That's an interesting question. My instinctive response here, based on sort of looking into this a few years ago, would be that actually he had internal issues politically. So there were people who were not at all comfortable with the strength of his anti-Semitism, and they felt that their society was being taken in a direction that they were not happy with. So I feel like a Stauffenberg plot as such, or something similar, an assassination attempt or something of a coup, is very likely to have happened because of the internal political German scenario. We have to remember, going back to pre-Nazi Germany, that as we've indicated already, there is a huge range of political opinion within Germany, and a lot of people were domestically rather unhappy, so they would likely have taken action, possibly quite likely violently if required.
Well, I disagree, but only because I think that actually 1940, with France defeated and what have you, he's achieved so much, and it took the Germans 4 years to fail to capture Paris in World War I, and he manages in 4 weeks. So at that stage, I think a lot of the opposition we see later on, like the Stauffenberg bomb plot, I think was largely the result of the failure on the Eastern Front. But actually, I think Stauffenberg was perfectly happy with the fall of France, thrilled. So maybe actually, there's a case perhaps to say that actually, had he stopped short, then it would have been more stable and what have you. Obviously, he'd always have Britain on the side, so whether the plucky Brits may have messed things up, I don't know.
And the USA may have had a view on it as well. Cool. Let's move on to another question, please.
With Hitler on the far right and Mao on the far left, would it be true to say that their authoritarian rule is actually very similar, despite their conflict in political ideology?
An excellent question. Yeah, we need to dissect this quite carefully. So let's do that.
Yes. If you actually think about your classic political spectrum, it's better if you imagine it like a horseshoe, where the two ends come down together. So actually the two ends are fairly close together in terms of the countries that they create. One side, of course, the extreme right wing would say, that the state is the most important. It's all about national pride above all else. But on the extreme left, equally, the state is the most important part of an extreme socialist state, because it all companies are state-owned, state-controlled land. So actually, the two systems of government are actually fairly similar, even though the ideologies are polar opposites.
Yeah, one more question. Okay. Well, thank you very much for coming, and I hope you found enjoyment.